meritocracy affirms a certain idea of freedom. This is the idea that our destiny is in our hands, that our success does not depend on forces beyond our control, that it is up to us. We are not victims of circumstance, but masters of our fate, free to rise as far as our efforts and talents and dreams will take us, or, if we choose, free to embrace the void.
Pathetic earthlings, hurling your bodies out into the void without the slightest inkling of who or what is out here.
Is life just some kind of horrific joke without a punchline? That we're all just biding our time until the sweet, sweet release of death?
Don't save Riley!
Take her to the moon for me, okay?
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Embrace the Void, where we clearly just hate good things like virtue and merit. I'm your host, Aaron Rabinowitz, and my returning guest this week is Gil Morejon, a historian of ideas currently teaching at Grinnell College and one of the four amazing hosts of the What's Left of Philosophy podcast, my go-to source for all things praxis. Gil writes a lot on folks like Leibniz, Hume, our shared boy Spinoza. Like me, he shares an interest in questions about ethical distribution or why is our current political climate trying to kill us. So I'm very excited to have him back on to talk about some leftist infighting about meritocracy. So Gil, would you like to once again say hi to the void?
Hello, void. How's it been?
You know, voidy, dude. You.
Yeah, yeah.
Samesies. Meritocratic rat race, eh?
Oh, yeah, we love it. Race to the bottom.
Yeah, so I am currently losing my mind in the third chapter of four chapters of my dissertation, which is the politics chapter. So naturally, I went back to the beginning, aka my source for all good actual modern political philosophy, y'all's podcast. And for folks who aren't familiar, way back when, y'all had me on to do a discussion on what has basically become the first two chapters of my dissertation about luck pilling. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my probably all-time favorite discussions about that I recorded. I recommend it to anybody who wants to understand what I'm trying to rot upon the world. So I really appreciated that. And when I came back and checked in with you, you also pointed me towards y'all's episode about equality of opportunity versus outcome, which is really excellent, and folks should go back and check that out. And it made me want to like talk to you about like leftist infighting about meritocracy, basically. So here
right.
We are.
No, yeah, that's right. It was the episode we had with you was really great, and yeah, it's great to be here and to be able to talk to you again.
Yeah, so let's start at the biggest, broadest question, and then we can spiral into a million places from there. Meritocracy, merit, these are terms that are themselves contested. So what is your understanding of meritocracy? What are its sort of cultural roots and consequences as you see it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't like work on the concept of meritocracy in my independent research so much. So I am working a little bit off of, you know, a combination of ways I've encountered it in other contexts, kind of my own intuitions about the thing, and then some of the research that you pointed me towards. But it seems like meritocracy is something like either an ideology or a description of an institutional system in which some distributive mechanism is in place that operates according to some principle of merit. And there's dispute even in terms of like what should be the principle of merit that effectuates the distributive mechanism. It could be effort, right? The ability or actual putting in a degree of labor or making a specific kind of contribution. These presumably would have to be quantified in some way. And in a lot of the literature recently, it seems like the debates are being had around meritocracy as organized around the principle of like qualification, specifically with regard to like educational qualification. You know, do you have credentials? Are you certified? Is it accredited? Right. And that this should be used to determine the extent to which people involved in an institution or maybe something as broad as society should be rewarded on the basis of having merited something, right? Whether that means like income or life chances and so on. This is, I'll say out of the gate, I don't like meritocracy. I think that one of the things, I mean,
yeah,
one of the sort,
take.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, one of the things that ends up happening in a lot of discussions, even center left, we can call like left liberal discussions meritocracy in the present society, like, you know, specifically in the United States, where we like to think that we are meritocratic or that our society operates according to meritocratic principles. And a kind of left liberal critique says, unfortunately, no, it's not, right? That this is a society in which meritocracy is not being actuated correctly. And then there are various different explanatory mechanisms as to why that might be. You know, perhaps the educational system is prone to a certain kind of corruption or elite capture. Maybe if you're a little more of a historical materialist, you might say that there are imminent dynamics to capital and capital accumulation that prevent meritocratic distribution from actually taking place. But the sort of premise or presupposition here is that meritocracy would be good if only we had it. I'm not so sure, though. I think that the more radical left position has to be, as I said in our episode about what's left of equality, I think the genuine left position has to be universalist, and especially with the provision at least of basic goods and necessities, and I would say probably at least to a certain degree with regards to like the ability to enjoy luxury goods or to live a kind of flourishing life. I don't think it makes any good sense for a left progressive position to like think that these are things that ought to be partitioned out or distributed according to any supposed merit, right? Like you, I also happen to have like determinist sympathies, such that like whenever someone talks about like having earned X or Y, I'm always like, what are you talking about? It sort of seems to me like people find themselves where they are for varieties of reasons. And then to say, because of that, right, you know, your life chances were relatively curtailed because you were born in a certain place and time, and then the ability of effort or contribution that you might have might be limited, that therefore you deserve less, seems morally arbitrary to me. So I think that, like, you know, one of the debates that's being had around this question is, yeah, this sort of fundamental debate or dispute between whether or not the problem is the meritocratic institutions aren't doing what they're supposed to, but they should, because meritocracy would be good. A second position that says, you know, maybe the institutions need some work, but this ideology of meritocracy is itself kind of a problem, maybe something that's getting in the way. As to the recent literature, you pointed me specifically towards this stuff by Markowitz. I think it's, is that right? The Meritocracy Trap?
Yeah, Meritocracy Trap, yeah, I think is the best of the books about it.
Yeah, and his position seems to be, you know, I wonder the extent to which his overall orientation is Marxist or anti-capitalist. One of the sort of critical responses to his work suggests that he, like some other sort of meritocracy critics, are still too wedded to capitalism as maybe it's a Tina, you know, there is no alternative. Who knows? I don't exactly know where he'd stand on this. But he nevertheless is pointing to lots of dynamics in the development of late capitalism starting sometime in the mid-20th century. We have, you know, incredible widening inequality. In a sort of like anthropological, sociological vein, he's on the team with people like David Graeber talking about how we've seen a proliferation of bullshit jobs that aren't well compensated. And then on the other hand, we've got, you know, an extraordinarily stratified, ultra elite wealthy who I can't think of anyone deserving less money than Elon Musk, but I guess it's not up to me. And so there's lots of,
he does
of,
successfully
like,
signal that he deserves it, right? With his 70-hour work.
He's doing a really great job signaling that he doesn't deserve anything. It's wild.
No. So, like, I think you set the table really well there. There's a lot of pieces I want to put on, sort of like highlight. Your use of the word universalist, I love, because I want to talk about the theological precursors to what is viewed generally as a secular debate. And I think that's really important because, right, our first question here is, how are we defining merit? Not just, I think he did a good job defining the kinds of meritocracy, right? Like, either there's what I think of as kind of technocracy, which is just the person who has the merit, has the skill, can do the thing, should do the thing.
Yeah.
Versus they deserve some sort of benefits or outcomes. It's that deserving part that seems
yeah.
really important. And it seems like that's connected to stuff that you have researched some, which is the kind of theological precursors to this, which are, it seems like, connected to issues around salvation,
yeah.
faith versus good deeds. And maybe under that, the debate about universal salvation. So maybe do you want to talk a bit about like how you see that conversation building into meritocracy?
Yeah, totally. We did an episode a while back on Weber's Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, and we were very mean to him. So it might be surprising that I'm about to speak so kind of favorably of his work. There, the sort of crux of our debate was that we think that there's a kind of latent idealism to the sort of sociological work that he does, as opposed to a kind of more materialist Marxian approach. And I think that's probably right. But I do think that there is value in the kind of, yeah, sociological history of ideas and genealogy, if you like, that mm-hmm. we get in Weber's account here. So the basic pitch is something like the following. We get a mutation of certain ideas around grace and salvation in the Christian theological tradition, starting with Luther, yes, but kind of really radicalized in Calvin and then in mm-hmm. Baxter, who mm-hmm. by the 1600s, is expounding what we now think of as like the theology of the Protestant work ethic. So the problems that kind of motivate this are as follows.
You get, do you want to really quick explain the Protestant work ethic?
Yeah. I'm going to try to unpack it.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. There is a, first of all, basically most theologians in the 1600s, by the time of the 1600s, don't buy into a universalist salvation, right? They think that there is going to be a group of the elect and a group of the damned or of the condemned. The question is why? And the classical theological answer, which goes all the way back to Augustine, is that, well, the elect, the saved, are those who are given grace. So in its side of real deep roots, right, Augustine has this debate with like the Pelagians, another group of Christian thinkers who think that you can earn your salvation through good works. And Augustine mm-hmm. refuses this because basically on his account, this would amount to a limitation on God's freedom. Right. In other words, you're constraining God to give you grace if you just like do nice stuff. And that doesn't seem like the sort of thing a lowly little finite creature like I should be able to do.
But would be necessary for free will and moral responsibility, right? Like
it's exactly.
kind of a, like you yeah. have free will and that constrains God's ability to save you a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit, right? And so like, you know, for Augustine, the classical solve is to say you have free will, yes. But whether or not you have it within you to turn your will toward the good, that is toward God, is subsequent to whether God gives you grace, right? And in any case, you know, with people like Jansenius, who kind of revitalized this Augustinian way of thinking in the 1600s, it's really kind of extreme. You get people like Antoine Arnauld who are saying things like, yeah, God gives grace to some because he's good, and not to others because he's just, and he doesn't owe anyone anything, right? So it's pretty...
always trying to make their God more of a dick than he needs to be, I feel like.
I know. Well, there's a response to this by Malebranche in his discourse or treatise on nature and grace, where in just his little preface, he's like, some people have taken their like rational arguments so far that like their God is just like an unrecognizable monster. He's like, I don't know.
Yep.
And he's definitely got on in mind.
And their name is Calvin.
Yeah, right? Anyway, so we've got this sort of thing that there can't be salvation through works because it's God's free will to give you grace or not that determines whether or not you're among the elect or if you're going to spend the rest of eternity in hell. Mm-hmm. And that sucks because I'd like to know if I'm going to heaven or hell if I'm a good committed Christian in the 1600s.
Right. Right. At least give us a tip off here.
Give me a tip, right? And so with people like Baxter's Protestant work ethic says, well, reflecting on whether or not you have faith isn't good enough because everyone wants to think they have faith and they have the grace that saves. So mm-hmm. you kind of can't trust yourself. But if you are a good person, you'll reveal that through your good works. As a result, you should work really fucking hard and be disciplined in your labor. Find a vocation, a calling to which you...
God wants gains.
God wants maximum gains, bro. And some of y'all are skipping leg day is really what's working. What's up here. Yeah. So he says, you know, find your vocation and have tireless discipline in your calling. And, you know, try to make as much money as you can, which is a crazy thing to say. At the same time, he thinks that there is...
Unless you're Peter Singer.
I know, right? Elizabeth Anderson suggests in that talk that, like, Baxter's basically an effective altruist.
She's got a book out about this, too, which I was listening to, which is like... Yeah, she's like utilitarianism just cribbed from Protestant
just
work ethic kind of stuff.
Straight out. Yeah, ACT utilitarianism's first version was this weird preacher in England, right? So,
which like tracks for ACT utilitarianism.
It sure does. So it's not that your works will save you, right? That can't be the case. But maybe your demonstrative, performative hard work and tireless service and discipline can be taken as a sign that you've got the grace that means you're among the saved, right? So this is the early theological roots of the Protestant work ethic, and it was clearly very powerful and motivating because you get all these like lunatic hardworking communities that grow up on the basis of these theological teachings. Mm-hmm. So that's like the real early root of it, right?
Well, yeah, and we should caveat, of course, that this is not the only place in the world in which a work ethic emerges. It's not the only place in the world in which forms of meritocracy arise.
Totally.
It is simply one particularly extreme version that has taken over the world.
It's a particularly extreme and austere and ascetic version that just, I think, basically... So, like, if I have an objection to Weber, he's like, oh, and this is why we get capitalism. And I'm like, okay, right. I don't know if the causal stories, that's that clean, right? Because, like, you know, in the original teachings, you know, if you read Calvin, he's not like worried. He knows he's among the saved, right? One of the things that I think does happen is you get a kind of drift where ideas elaborated initially on theological soil do become secularized. So for various reasons, I do think that, especially in like Anglophone countries, you get a kind of increasingly secular sense for the rightness of these ideas about the need for tireless work and that, you know, the material gains that you get from them are earned, right? Are deserved and not just like materially because you worked hard, but like spiritually. It means you're a good person that you have all of this to show for the hard work that you've put in. So like then the Industrial Revolution happens. For one reason or another, we wind up with like a capitalist system in which the basic imperative of social organization of production, distribution, and exchange is the accumulation of capital. And we get a regime of exploiting waged labor. So some of these ideas ideologically about the need for hard work return with a vengeance, especially by the time we get to like the second half of the 20th century. Anderson's also right to say that like the real secular version of the bad way to uptake this is given in Thomas Malthus, right? Who sees like in England in his time, the poor laws are being passed, which are these kinds of like early but relatively comprehensive attempts at, you know, social insurance or the provision of certain kinds of basic minimum below which even the poor won't fall. And he's like, this is so fucked up. You are just producing material incentives for people to be
tragedy
lazy.
Of the commons, people. Tragedy of the commons.
Yeah. You know, could there be anything more repugnant that he was a preacher to and a freak?
This is really great. This is a great tie-in for me because I have a theory here that I want to like. Because the reason I brought this up in relation to the concept of merit is that like there's lots of different definitions of merit over the course of human history. The Spartans have one. The Athenians have one. We got one, right? Yeah. And in the like definition of like in the choice between options, the modern world, I think, picks hard work over talent, or claims to at least, right?
Claims to.
Not sure. Actually, right? But like,
right.
If we're talking about the meritocratic propaganda that is running the machine, it is that hard work is more important than talent. If you work hard enough, you know, your tortoise in your hair kinds of stuff, right? And that, it seems like, is coming out of those kinds of Protestant effortful as like conspicuous production kind of traditions.
Nice. Yeah.
Right. So I think that's useful for us to understand then why that both is super useful for capitalism, yeah. Right? Whether or not it creates capitalism, yeah, yeah, yeah. To understand totally why capitalism useful. Is like, I'll take two of those, please.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? And also why it, I think it does start from a good place, but quickly ends up in a bad place. Like, not all of it starts from a good place, but there is, sure. So there's a sense in which I am arguing that the modern world is the product of us increasingly acknowledging the problem of luck, that luck is pervasive in our lives, that it makes us feel icky about the inequitable distributions of resources and stuff totally. Like that. We hate those icky feelings, so we got to do something about them, right? Mm-hmm. And what we do is we make up a cluster of illusions that tell us it's fine.
Yeah.
We got the just world illusions, you got your divine intervention illusions, and you got your meritocracy and free will. And those four make it all okay.
Yeah,
you know, like,
work.
And you know, they all hang together in a way that like makes it such that people can genuinely believe that Elon Musk deserves billions of dollars, and conversely, that the people who are poor and starving to death and dying should decrease the surplus population, motherfuckers, because like you're not yeah, good yeah, yeah. people. You're bad people. We know yeah, you're bad people yeah. because of the elect evidence
because
that you
you're
are a
poor.
Bad person. Right.
Yeah.
And like your lack of success proves that God doesn't like you.
Yeah. Yeah. Not just to get completely sidetracked, but like I saw Jordan Peterson say something like this on it in a tweet not too long ago, where he was playing around with ChatGPT and actually he was playing around with Grok, which is Twitter X's chat AI. Yeah, yeah. And he was like bummed out to discover that on his account it's quote just as woke as ChatGPT. And his
because
evidence
copying
for this was
GPT.
Probably. Yeah, but like with the actual proposition that Grok produced that made him so upset was that being poor might lead to moral corruption and not the other way around, which he's just for him is just obvious, right? But this is like a completely Protestant work ethic way of thinking in its reactionary secular form. Because I do think it's true as well that there are other elements in the original Baxter style theological claim about how like, yeah, you shouldn't be indolent. And like in the time of the 16 and 1700s, that idea is being used as a weapon against the rich aristocrats. The landlords who are just sitting around passively draining rents and like not doing anything. And so like what Anderson refers to as like this neoliberal inversion is like, yeah, where's that for our elites today? You know, where's the smoke about not being lazy for the wealthy, where all of it is focused now on the supposed laziness of the poor, which again is ridiculous empirically, both because like, labor productivity has never been so insanely high, and just the amount of product, the amount of actual production being done is like staggering. And also because like the poor work so fucking hard compared to like even middle class people most of the time, and certainly more so than like the wealthy. You know, we're talking
usually about worse jobs that like damage their bodies more, etc. Like in every ways are more costly.
Worse jobs that ruin their bodies, and it's mentally drudge.
Worse times, worse schedules.
Yeah,
less
worse
freedom.
Times, worse schedules, yeah. Less freedom of movement, no freedom of association. We've got like, you know, factories where people are getting shut in and the doors are locked and they're made to work 16-hour days and they're making pennies on the dollar. It's not because they're lazy that they're poor. It's because we have an inequitable economic system that is designed solely for capital accumulation. It's that straightforward. But this ideological association of poverty with a vicious moral character, a deficient moral character, being a sign of being unworthy, that's a very pervasive idea. And one that I think is easy to onboard or internalize, even for the people who are hardworking, working class people, right? This is like,
Well, that's the problem is they do internalize it so easily, right? So
yeah,
you mentioned sort of Anderson's claims about neoliberalism, right? Anderson, I think, in that book makes a great argument that the Protestant work ethic, like say what you will about the Puritans, you don't have to hand it to them, but
at least they had an ethos.
Some of them to some extent like respected the worker, you know, in a way that like modern meritocracy only respects elite workers.
Yes.
They respected the day-to-day worker kind of view as well. And that is part of that neoliberal inversion. I pulled a quote from Markowitz who says, you know, that classical liberalism and neoliberalism, which he says is just an offshoot of classical liberalism, are both just a roundabout way of saying that meritocratic hierarchies are okay while others are not.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yes.
Now, Markowitz would say the answer to your question about, like, what about the indolent rich is there aren't any anymore. They've all been driven into extinction by the meritocratic elites who all pretend, you know, whether or not they're doing it or not, and many of them are, claim to be working enough hours to, you know, like justify their absurd amount of money. And then they also, you know, hop on effective altruism and say we're donating, you know, a bunch of our money. And so like, it's okay that we have this giant pile that's still here and still have control over everything in the universe and stuff. That's totally fine.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to say a couple things about this. First of all, I haven't spot checked all of the sort of sociological research that he's drawing on to make this empirical claim about like the, you know, the work obsessed upper crust. Mm-hmm. I'll certainly grant that there is at least a subculture in some sectors to be like this, right? That there is like, again, a kind of conspicuous...
Academia being one of them.
Yeah, totally. Academia
is one. Let's
talk
about our home.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Or again, like the tech bro world is absolutely lousy with these freaks who like just wear gray sweatshirts and say they work 80-hour weeks. And like, some of them probably do that, I'm sure. Some of them maybe believe it. Some of them maybe are doing it performatively. Who knows? I doubt that this is like a majority of people who have like the most money on the planet. I can't, I just actually am, like I said, I don't have counter sociology.
It's a very American viewpoint, right?
Yeah.
Like your Saudi nobles are probably like getting a lot of education.
I don't think they're working very hard.
Yeah. Right. They're getting a lot of education. Well, so there's a mixed thing going on here, right? There is a lot more, you know, we send you to the elite schools, you get the best education.
Right.
And then maybe you use that to run our government, but not, it is still kind of that, like, you do more, a lot more falconry, right? And a lot less, like, not falconry.
I think that's probably right. And again, like, I'm not sure that this translates. We can easily imagine this with our, like, again, our tech bro billionaire CEOs, like Sam Bankman-Fried and whomever else, you know, very morally upstanding, effective altruist types who...
strong proponents of non-free will, super helpful there, thanks guys.
Uh-huh. But like, I don't know, is it the case that like the people, like the Waltons are really hardworking, you know, who own Walmart, or like the shareholders of like Boeing, are they like on their 80-hour a week grind? Like, I don't know.
Well, so this is where one of the many ways in which there are like little cracks of injustice that get plastered over, I think, in this argument, right? So inherited wealth, right, makes no fucking sense on any of these views.
Completely morally arbitrary, yeah.
Completely, like 100, like an estate tax should be a moral no-brainer on literally
really
every level.
Crazy.
Right?
Smith
and instead
said
we basically
this.
Eliminated it, right?
Yeah, like, Adam Smith was like, come on, that's ridiculous.
Come on, guys. It's such a low bar. Libertarians are like, wait a minute, I can get under that one.
Right.
So, well, yeah, what we have is this problem where people are like, literally, the libertarians are like, but freedom. Freedom. And people are like, you're right. He's got a good point. So, yeah, no estate tax.
Fine.
Right. So just like radical wealth inequality for all time. No ability to claw any of that back.
Yeah. You get your like Nozick argument about like the just process by which we got here means that pointing to the end state is just a morally arbitrary move, which, you know, I guess, but also I don't buy, like, whatever.
What I do think, like, to bring us back to the politics of this, right? Yeah. Like, what is this doing to humans in the real world? It is impressive the degree to which meritocracy, I think we can agree at least that in the past 100 years, meritocracy drove the previous ideology around effort to extinction.
Yeah.
Even if there are like wealthy, you know, yacht sitting elites out there, they're hiding, right? And they're like, they're living in their own, you know, socially segregated world so that they don't get overrun by pitchforks and stuff. And they don't have to see us because we're hideous. At the same time, ideology.
Fair enough, I don't
want to
see me either. Like, I get it. Yeah.
Right. The ideology has successfully convinced them that they deserve what they have, and has convinced everybody else, I think, that they deserve what they have, and that we deserve what's left. You know, you still have so much data that shows that, like, people mostly think the system is fair, and where it's unfair, the concerns, like you pointed out at the beginning, are about it not being meritocratic enough, right? Like, a little bit too much racism, systemic racism, maybe, or something. Like,
yeah, not great.
A little more procedural cleaning up, and then we're there kind of thing, rather than we need to, like, totally upend this concept.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's wild, too, like... this is analogous to, I think of this line in Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism book at some point, where he's talking about the classroom in his time in the late 2000s. And he says, anyone who's taught in the modern world knows that Foucault's analysis of disciplinary power is just totally out of, like, completely obsolete. We don't live in the world where the problem is everyone in the classroom is too disciplined. That's not it. And I think that there's some, and there's something similar I was just thinking of here, like with Veblen, because like you read Veblen's theory of the leisure class and he's got these categories of like conspicuous consumption and whatever, you know, pecuniary invidious comparison or whatever. He's got a great way with language. But he's talking about something that is like uncannily familiar and completely unfamiliar, right? For reasons that I think are probably related to this ascendancy of meritocracy idea that you're pointing out. Like, amongst themselves, the wealthy are very pleased to do their conspicuous consumption, but they also like to do it behind gated walls. Because when we see too much of it, we start sharpening the pitchforks. And they know that, right? And they know that that strikes us as unfair, because even if we are, you know, pro-meritocrat people who think that, you know, you've earned your keep, the numbers just are too fucking crazy these days, right? Like, there's no way to work as a CEO 80,000 times harder than the person who's working in the facility that you own and operate. That's not a thing. There's no, so like having a mega yacht is just not going to be easy to justify, even to the people who buy the merit story, I think. At the same time, you're totally right that like it's it's basically one as an ideology. And the thing, the most policy discussions are blinkered by this kind of fidelity to its basic premise that like, yeah, maybe certain sort of institutional structures are corrupt, or there are social injustices like racism structurally or systematically that need to be corrected for, so that the good meritocratic thing can kick in and do its job, right? And yeah, this is like the sort of limits of policy. And in the United States, it's even worse than in certain countries in Europe, which at least have some remnants of the democratic socialist welfare state, although they're, you know, rushing to dismantle those as fast as possible too in most countries.
For meritocratic reasons.
For meritocratic reasons, exactly. Because, you know, you don't want things like, you don't want to give the poor healthcare if they haven't demonstrated work or that they're searching for work. And this the premise here is like, that's the meritocratic premise, right? That like, work will set you free. Like, you know, you need to prove your worthiness. Arbeit macht frei. You know, you need to prove your worthiness of not dying of a preventable disease, you know, which again is, if you're at all like, if you have any like moral integrity, is just disgusting, right? It's disgusting.
Right. So before we talk about like policy options on these issues, because I want to talk some about like the problem of real politics and utopian stuff.
Sure.
I want to talk first though, like, there's two places I want to go. First, I want to talk about like some of the like connected concepts to see how we feel about those connected concepts. And then I want to understand, like, is there a leftist position for meritocracy, right? Are there far left individuals who are still like, let's just do meritocracy, but like the far leftist version of that? Before we talk about that, though, I want to talk about a few other things. One is technocracy. Okay. This comes up a lot in these books. I understand this to essentially be rule by, or, you know, like control by expertise.
Yeah.
And the problem is usually the definition of expertise. I'm curious, are you pro-technocracy? And like, what do you see as like the big problems of the definition of expertise that we need to address if we're going to keep our technocracy?
Hilarious. Well, yeah, this is tricky, right? Because it's funny because like, it's one of those things where on the face of it, like if someone comes up to you and asks like, hey, would you like the people in charge to be competent? And I'm like, no, that sounds bad. Like, of course, yeah, I'd like I'd like whatever is in charge or whomever is in charge to be good at that. So then all of the difficulty comes down to, like, literally, I'm not sure what it would mean. What it would mean to say no to that? That's a ridiculous.
It's such a philosopher move. The philosopher runs in. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. This idea of competent people doing the thing. None of that.
Right.
Walk but it like, back.
Well, because like, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Then the whole question is how one defines expertise, what the mechanisms are institutionally for determining what counts as expertise. Our current systems for doing this, I think, are demonstrably quite flawed. And there's lots to say here about, I think, you know, Femi's work on elite capture is really good for thinking about this. That's Olu Femi Taiwo.
Friend of the show.
Friend of the show, yeah. Friend of every show, he's the best.
Friend of the
pod. But yeah, like, so part of why I found some of these books and texts on recent meritocracy work so confusing initially is because they focus so much on credentials and education. And I thought that was confusing. And I'll explain really quickly why I found that was confusing. Because you get these like very apocalyptic sounding condemnatory descriptions of present society, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
Oh my God.
Why inequality is going to kill all of us in the next 10 years.
Inequality is going to kill all of us. Social mobility is in the toilet. We have like incredible resentment on the part of the disenfranchised, the working class, and the systematically under and unemployed, the precariat.
The rich are loading up their golden space shuttles.
The rich are loading up their golden space shuttles and building bunkers in Java because they know that the seawater is going to rise and drown it. And then it's like, okay, so what should we do? And it's like, well, let's make admissions a bit more fair at elite universities. And I'm like, what the fuck? That is a completely disproportionate, like small scale offer as a solution here. But I think I understand why that's the move for someone who's bought into a certain understanding of the technocratic premises, again, of our current society, because elite educational systems seem to be the only thing that we agree can confer like a legitimate claim to qualification, right? Now, that's weird if you've ever been in a university, because that's just kind of not what they do, as, depending on the kind of education we're looking at. But I mean, especially like in terms of like, talk to anyone who teaches at or has gone to an MBA program, and they will tell you that like, yeah, we're going to convey some information in the classroom, but this is mostly about networking and maybe figuring out some like sort of social etiquette. They're like finishing schools because, you know, the minute you get hired by a firm, they're going to tell you how they do things anyway, and it's going to be different. So then having the degree doesn't mean anything like qualification at all. Not to speak of the fact that, yeah, as it turns out, like, yes, these are the sorts of things that if we want to make little instrumental changes to, we can try to tweak that, like, you know, empirically, it's incredibly well evidenced that like people of color, you know, women, non like cis hetero white people tend to just do worse at college, not because of any sort of like lack of quote unquote talent or effort, but due basically to subtle and not so subtle forms of discrimination. That then we have like, you know, uneven distribution of the apparent qualifications across these populations that just reinforce existing inequalities and relations of domination.
Right.
And so like using the college as a way to determine who's qualified just doesn't seem like a very good idea to me. Now, the problem, of course, is that I'm just not really sure what else we could point to. I don't know, demonstrated competency is different than holding a degree. But we also live in a society where like having the degree is a prerequisite for getting in the door to try to do a job like 90% of the time. And again, there's a kind of like class antagonistic resentment here. You mentioned earlier, like the early Protestant work ethic had a kind of respect for certain kinds of labor. Ours is a society that just does not look well at like all of the manual labor that is objectively socially
except
necessary.
Except every 4 years.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, okay, well, how politically myopic can we possibly be about this? Like, not to like, not to drive the point home too clearly, but like, if I die tomorrow, like, very little is going to be negatively affected in terms of keeping the wheels of society going. But like, you know, a construction worker, a truck driver, these aren't well regarded in terms of social status, but they're like literally crucial. Indispensable for society.
Yeah. I read like 10 million meritocratic books that have been written in the past 4 years, you know, while I was prepping for this. And probably 60 to 70% of them referenced essential workers during COVID as the reason why they were at home writing about how fucked we are and how like clearly we're not doing the thing we say we're doing. Right. So, yeah, I'm sympathetic to that. And like my answer, I think on the like, I agree that the suggestions that I've seen put forward so far seem wildly small and disproportionate to the problem, and that's why I'm going to shoot the utopian moon here in a second.
Oh, yeah. Me too, pal.
On
I got
policy,
ideas.
Yeah. But I don't think these are necessarily bad things to include in the sense that I'm not willing to jettison technocracy. I think the like normative meritocracy's got to go, but I think the idea of capacity is still valuable, and that I think. So Sandel, for example, in The Tyranny of Merit, one of his small bore solutions is mixed luckocracy with regard to admissions, where if you have a certain basic, SAT or whatever level of blah, 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 we put you in a pool and then we select a number of people equal to how many we're going to admit every year. And you can even weight that pool with things like affirmative action weighting or something. But at the end of the day, it's a lottery, right? I do think that's an improvement over the current model. I think it actually adds a variety of interesting benefits. It's not in itself like going to be, I think it was Anderson or one of them who just points out that like so often we're trying to solve these massive upstream social problems with like education.
Yeah.
Which like, I get it. I mean, yeah. At the same time, the end of my book is going to be like, let's solve these massive upstream social problems with education. But like, I think we have to do that.
Again, like it's not bad to like make the education system more accessible.
There's really not upstream or downstream problems, right?
Yeah,
it's just a big pool of problems. And like, I think to some extent you do have to teach the next generation to just despise the current system enough to replace it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And to do that, you've got to root these ideas out of the education system itself that is reproducing them over and over again in like growth mindsets and,
yes,
you know, your gifted and talented to hard drug use pipeline.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that it's been easier, I think, to do that, right? To push students towards radical revolutionary or abolitionist politics with regard to existing institutions since 2008, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, because like this is a group of people, this is a generation of young people whose parents maybe were first generation who went to college and they lived in the sort of post-war boom years, even though of course things were starting to get stripped, that we were starting to strip the wires out of society starting in the 1970s with the neoliberal turn. But even so, like through the 80s and even into like the 90s, like if you went to college and got a degree, there was a fairly good chance you were going to be pretty upwardly socially mobile and that you'd land at least a decently paying middle class job with benefits and you'd have a pension and retire at 65 or whatever. And you wouldn't like, you know, die in obscurity and poverty. And like since 2008, like everyone in college is like, welp, I guess I got to do this and go into debt for it, even though I don't believe there's a job for me, right? Mm-hmm, and that sort of is, that's a different sort of affective sense of oneself in relation to these existing institutions. And in part, I think it, you know, this is where a utopian imagination is necessary. In part, it's kind of just the inertia of like, well, yeah, this is just what one does and what else is there to do but to go to college. I want to try to get a job, even though I know that the economic outlook is bad, but like I'm going to need a degree even if it doesn't work out. And then, you know, yeah, the way we go.
I feel like that chasm really opened over the course of our generation where like half the people we know, like we were all told go to college and that's what, you know, like half of them just fell into a gaping maw of that, like,
yeah,
you know, like predatory lending,
oh my God,
amongst other things,
yeah,
right? And so here we are in this modern economic crisis. And like on the series of economic crises that are threatening us, one of them is student loans crushing a bunch of people forever and ever and ever. But that's another, that brings up, I think, in relation to another interesting point, which is one of the things that's been most depressing in all of reading these things is all of my like progressive liberal ancestor, you know, like people who were trying to do better and help and reduce luck, like it's their mechanisms that like made things like not in the way that Malthus thought it was going to happen, but in very different kinds of horrible ways, like created all these horrible perverse incentives. But I want to like
could
tie
you give
this
an example of like what you mean by that?
Well, yeah, I just want to tie it back to like the loans and like a quality of opportunity versus a quality of outcome.
Nice, good.
Kind of stuff,
yeah,
right? So
yeah,
from y'all's episode, right? Like there's this big idea where one way to understand meritocratic neoliberalism is sort of a fetishizing of a quality of opportunity.
100%.
And what we're arguing for is some version of a quality of outcome, which is evil for reasons, authoritarianism, whatever.
Of course.
And what we see are like these horrible half measures where like we sort of try to achieve a quality of opportunity via student loans, but then
right,
because we still have this puritanical work ethic,
yeah,
we fuck you over for taking the student loans,
right,
and not working yourself to death for them. I feel like there's a question in there. I guess my question here is, what is your views about a quality of opportunity versus outcome, and how do
totally
we like cut that Gordian knot?
Yeah, nice. I mean, like, so yeah, it's one of those things where like on its own, the concept of equality of opportunity can't be a bad thing. You know what I mean? Like that everyone has opportunities, like, cool, great, fine. The problem is that this idea that what we should be after in a good liberal society, a good democratic liberal capitalist society, is ensuring that everyone has equal equality of opportunities, is a cudgel used to dissuade us from thinking more concretely about equality of outcomes or of real flourishing, right? In other words, you know, what we end up doing is restricting the set of possible policies that are going to be politically acceptable or which don't contradict, frankly, the basic imperatives of capital accumulation, to say that, no, the only things that we can do is tinker with systems to make sure that equality of opportunity is achieved. There's several problems with this. One of them is that it may, you know, thinking that this is, A, first of all, we've not heard a good argument for no equality of outcome, really, other than that it's authoritarian and whatever.
You're going to take everybody's money and everyone will end up poor. Leveling right. down objections, basically.
Yeah, whatever. You know,
your Harrison Bergerons.
Yeah, come on. Bad faith. Who cares? That's not interesting. But what we wind up doing is, like, we think then, or there's a tendency to think, even amongst, like, left liberals, that, like, producing mechanisms that ensure greater degrees of equality of outcome means that, you know, at least we're moving in the right direction, but more problematically, it can blind us to systematic problems that can persist even in spite of genuine equality of opportunity. In other words, like, you know, just to be, again, just to be really blunt about it, right? Like, if everyone has equal opportunity to work in a sweatshop, that might not be such a good thing, right? If we have different normative
neutral hiring laws in your sweatshop.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, you know, there's that old Marxist joke that the only thing worse than not having a job is having one.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like the only thing worse than, you know, not having your labor be exploited is having your labor be exploited. Like, you know, this is a bit fast, but, like, the point is that, like, equality of opportunity's formal character means that persistent inequalities in lots of other ways can persist. People can be deprived of material things that they need. Or, again, what does opportunity even bind us to? It's just a promise of a possibility, right? Like, if everyone has equal opportunity to buy healthcare, that doesn't mean that anyone is going to end up being able to afford healthcare if it's just a good that's traded on the market. But it's still equally equally available to everyone. So, you know, I guess we're good. Mm. I think that as leftists, we need to take more seriously, like, concrete material needs, and on this basis, make the case that equality of opportunity is insufficient for realizing progressive ends. I think that those ends have to be things like, you know, universalist provision of basic necessities like food, housing, and healthcare. And that's not the same as saying everyone should be able to buy a house, which is currently the case, and we've got a massive homelessness problem. So do you see what I mean?
Yeah. And I think, like, so I think the basic needs thing is valuable. And, like, I want to, so let's move into policy, because I want to get real utopian about this now, because I agree with you that, like, there's a kind of leveling down with the quality of opportunity that isn't what we want. But then you start talking about concrete material needs. And earlier you used the F word, flourishing, which is one of my words personally, but I'm not sure. I don't really feel comfortable using it in political spheres, because I feel like I'm going to have to, defend myself meta-ethically about, like, my objectivist elitist claims about the idea that there is an objectively better or worse life, and that I should be nudging people towards suffering less, where suffering means something more than their own personal subjective preferences being met in a libertarian, you know, hellscape.
Yeah. Nice. I think, you know, this came up and Lillian was really, in our episode on this topic, I think Lillian was very forceful in...
Yeah.
In articulating, like, something like this, that her on her reading, and I think that there's a case that can be made. I think this is a defensible position, at least. It wasn't my, like, spontaneous thought, so this is why I'm kind of hedging. But I think it's at least workable. That, yeah, I think we can try to retain from liberalism, as much as, you know, in so many ways, I am left of a liberal position and I have all kinds of specific concrete policy desires that are probably going to be received as illiberal. But I think that we can and should attempt to retain from liberalism its relative value agnosticism or pluralism with regard to the systems of ends that people give themselves, what counts for them as a flourishing life or one that they take to be valuable and meaningful. And I don't think we don't need to impose a particular conception of the good or of the good life onto people. Because that, to be frank, is downstream from what I take to be the basic imperative of left progressive politics, which is establishing the conditions for the possibility of that flourishing in material terms, because those just don't exist right now in huge places and like huge parts of the world, such that, like, I guess maybe someday there might be reason to worry about like one person imposing their conception of the good on each other. But right now we're not even there, because we live in a world where the value overarching all things is that of capital accumulation. So I don't get to choose what my best life looks like, because I got to work so much, and I work way less than a lot of other people. So, I mean, I think flourishing is a nice thing to talk about, to sort of remember what our end goal is here, not in the form of imposing like a particular conception of what flourishing is. And I also understand that this probably can sound like a little bit of a dodge, right? Like, I'm kind of refusing to define the term in a way. But I do think that, like, you know, there's good reason to say that what flourishing might be different for different people, and that's fine, and that's their business, but they should be able to pursue that. They should be able to do that. And right now, the fact is that just so many can't, and it's not because they've made moral mistakes or they have defective characters. It's not because they don't deserve it, to go back to our merit trap. It's because, you know, material conditions are geared towards the reproduction of the class relation.
So, yeah, I'm sympathetic to a lot of that. I want to just clarify a few things. So value pluralism is very much my position, and I often worry sometimes that folks on the left have trouble like keeping on sides of pluralism versus relativism. Especially if you're in the more woke sympathetic world, you're going to be more likely to slide, I think, towards a relativist position, where you're going to say, look, if a person really feels like their life is a life of flourishing, than it necessarily is, right?
Good
a self-identification.
Yeah. None of my business. Yeah.
Right. But that ends you right back in the libertarian camp of like, hey, look, they signed the contract for slavery and they're flourishing under slavery in their own perspective, so that slavery is okay on our view. Whereas I do think that like our pluralism, for it to be really pluralistic, has to have a boundary, a limit, where beyond which we're going to say, look, this is not flourishing
human
beings.
Absolutely.
Right?
No, like I'm not at all averse to like a kind of, you know, Popperian principle, paradox of tolerance insight here, right? Like, I was just like the other day, like, so one of the things that's going viral right now is Chaya Raichik got interviewed by, I think, Taylor Lautner. And Chaya Raichik is the person who runs the Libs of TikTok Twitter account. So for the past several years, she's basically used her increasingly large platform to demonize and dox anyone who is a member of the LGBTQ community, and especially anyone who is like a teacher, right? And like it amounts to encouraging stochastic terrorism, and literal violence has been enacted on as a direct result of the way that she's using her platform. In the society that I want to live in, she doesn't get to have a platform anymore. I don't care, right? Like, to me, this isn't a debatable.
The amount of paternalism is okay.
Yeah, are you kidding me? Like, yeah, no. Like, if your conception of your flourishing life means like killing other people, you don't get to do that. Sorry, there have to be some boundaries that we're playing in here. I'm not sure why this is something that is so like, yeah, I guess like the question people always want to ask is like, oh yeah, but where do you draw the line? And I'm like, I don't know, but let's start there. Let's start with no stochastic terrorism. I'm not sure what the word is. Yeah.
I also think there are some positive requirements. I think the like education, I think people trying to claim that someone can really, like, the odds of a life of flourishing without an education, I think, are very, very low. Maybe not 0%, but like, you're very unlikely to live the kind of good life that I think you can live if you have a basic public education. That's why most of us believe that a basic good public education is a kind of universalist good in that sense, right? It's, you know, I don't believe anyone deserves anything, but if you were going to have a list of things everyone deserves, almost every human being would put basic education on the list.
Yeah, I agree.
Because they so fundamentally tie it to a life of flourishing, whatever they mean by that concept.
Right.
Another thing that I think is pretty much always, I think, essential to a life of flourishing, my sort of working definition with all of its problems, is kind of the projects of worth account of flourishing by someone like Wolf, is a flourishing life is one of meaning making, right? You have to feel like your life is doing something valuable, and it actually has to be doing something valuable, I would argue, for it to really be a life of flourishing. But another issue that comes up in the policy domain related to that is the sort of universal basic income stuff that we've brought up. So if we're universalists, right, and we're going to hand out a universal basic income, one big fear is, well, if you take away the incentive to work, and work is a big feature of meaning making for human beings, like, we're gonna end up in that dystopia where no one is incentivized to do anything but sit around and do drugs all day.
I guess. So, a couple things. First of all, if everyone ends up sitting around and doing drugs all day because their material needs are taken care of, like, fine, that's cool. I don't know. Who are they hurting?
I guess what I'm saying is I think we need to take care of more than just material. Like maybe material needs. So maybe when I hear material needs, I think like food, water, shelter, space, and not meaning.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay, so here's the thing. I think I don't disagree that, like, on probably most conceptions of flourishing will require something like that people understand their life and their life's work to be meaningful, probably, or at least that they have meaningful connections with others. I don't think that anyone can do that for someone else. In other words, if I think that, like, the conditions for the possibility of my having a flourishing, meaningful existence are in place, I can still botch that. Like, and it's no one's duty to make sure that I don't botch it with my own life, right? So, like, I just don't know how that could be, like externally legislated. I really don't. I think this is where something like a Kantian doctrine of virtue would have to step in, although I'm not co-signing Kant's actual doctrine of virtue.
Sure.
Yeah. For a variety of reasons.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, for obvious reasons. But this is just to say that, like, yeah, I think that, like, as a matter of policy, like, I just don't know if there's anything like policy that will, you know, make someone appreciate art or, you know, find value in their connections with loved ones. I think people will do that to the extent that they want to or can, but I can't guarantee anyone that they have a loved one. Do you know what I mean? When it
and no. Like, I'm so, like, I get it. And also, like, you know, on a long enough timeline, yes, we should guarantee. If you had, you know, there should be a goal towards that kind of universal providing for like even more very sophisticated needs. It's just increasingly difficult to do so, right? You're not going to solve it with your forced sex worker solutions or something like
that. Yeah, I mean, all of that is, like, pretty repugnant pretty quickly. I mean, I'm just...
Right.
Yeah, like I said, I don't know. I think that, like... And again, given a sort of baseline commitment to value pluralism, yeah, some people... Like, I just mentioned art, right? Like, and we've done some episodes on aesthetics and, you know, someone like Schiller would say that, like, you know, not just education, but aesthetic education is necessary for the sake of a good life. And, like... I agree insofar as, like, I find art really meaningful and I think it's an important a feature of human life, but you don't have to like art and I'm not going to make you, right? I'm not going to be like, you have to learn how to appreciate romantic orchestration or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, like the minute you start concretizing it, it becomes obvious why you can't do this, which is namely to say that, like, one's own conception of the good life is very open-ended, you know, given some basic constraints on, like, yeah, not violently oppressing others or whatever, that, like, yeah, you could find meaning or be happy with all kinds of things, with some things, not with others. And I think that has to be left up to people themselves to determine for themselves.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about elitism and flourishing a little more in the VIP stuff. I have one more question I want to ask you here, and then I'm going to torture you some. Often on y'all's show, y'all talk about something, and it got particular, you know, like Lillian especially got real big on this in that equality episode in a way that, you know, like, makes me nervous as I'm writing this chapter about the issue of, like, essentially moral philosophers trying to do public political philosophy as moral philosophy. That, like, and this was a bit of a sense of what I had with some of her criticism of my chapters when I was on y'all's show as well, was just like, I'm an ethicist coming from an ethics background, doing ethics, and, like, at the end of the day, a lot of times I do view politics as, like, ethics at scale.
Yeah.
And that seems like a bad thing in a way that I don't feel like I fully understand or understand, like, what are the questions I need to answer for me to be doing something that isn't just morality masquerading as politics, essentially.
Yeah. I think that one... You know, I just mentioned Kant, and again, not to, like, agree with, we just did an episode on Kant's doctrine of right from the Metaphysics of Morals. And this is maybe one thing to say, because I think you can see a lot of his political stuff there coming directly out, obviously, of his moral philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the distinction he draws there between a doctrine of right and a doctrine of virtue might be a helpful one for you to think about in this regard, because the distinction between them is that as regards what belongs to a doctrine of right, it's all that stuff that, yeah, we agree is good for our moral principled reasons, and we think that it's legitimate for these to be legislated on, that we could pass laws and establish policy that secures these things, that there are then duties that we need to follow, and so on and so forth. And a doctrine of virtue is also stuff that we all recognize is good, but for which no external legislation is possible. That, for instance, I have some kind of duty to myself, like not to ruin my mind with drugs and alcohol every day, we might agree with. But like, if I'm not hurting anyone and I'm doing it in my home, like, I don't know if there should be a law about that, you know? And so this is the kind of thing that maybe one first crack at it would be like, yeah, sometimes obviously normative commitments underlie and underwrite a lot of our political theory, but sometimes failing to respect that distinction means that like we let our moral intuitions influence policy in a way that's illegitimate or ill-advised.
Mm-hmm.
A second thing might be to say that like I think part of the worry with inflating moral theory into political theory is around what the basic difference is between like, yeah, a moral doctrine for myself as an individual who has to relate to others, and like the fact that social problems and political problems are about how to organize a polity, how to organize a large scale organization of human beings. And that just might require different principles in some cases, that, you know, thou shalt not kill, if I'm a good first, you know, unconditional categorical imperative Kantian, is like, great. And then like the minute Kant starts talking about the state, the first thing he does is be like, oh, but this, you can kill, the state can kill people, right? And this is not because like he's just like a big arbitrary lover of state power, though he is, but because he recognizes that different sorts of principles are required in the organization of a polity than in individual morality.
Mm-hmm. Part of me immediately wants to start fighting the middle distinction between like things that only harm yourself versus things that harm others.
Sure. Yeah.
And like, you know, I have in the book, in the dissertation exactly where Mill's like, you know, if you don't believe this, you're going to end up in a totalitarian state. And I'm like, maybe that's
always
better.
It's always maybe totalitarianism with the liberals.
But what if it worked out for us?
Yeah. It's like that Arrested Development joke.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, it's never worked out for anyone before, but it might work out for us.
Right.
I did want to say one last thing about policy before we escape.
Sure.
Because you mentioned UBI, and I think the real worry about UBI isn't that it's gonna make everybody a bunch of indolent, lazy idiots. I think the real worry is that it's often paired with, or it can be an instrument of neoliberalization, right? In other words,
absolutely.
You know, in a lot of cases, you get people like Andrew Yang's UBI proposal isn't just happening in a void. He's like, yeah, and also let's slash social spending, you know, and then people are back to just pure opportunity. Take your pile of cash and spend it where you will. Or, you know, the other argument economically against a UBI as being a potential remedy for social ills like homelessness is like, yeah, but then like the landlords will just drive the prices up if they know that everyone's got an extra grand in the bank every month. And that's probably right. They would do that. My like utopian public policy stuff is like, yeah, have a UBI, why not? But like, I think that those basic needs things, education, housing, healthcare, food, those need to be decommodified, that like access to those as goods that people require for the basic sustenance of their life and their reproduction and existence cannot be a matter of market mediation and profit. I just don't think that that is ethically defensible or practical, actually, in the long run. My utopian proposal, you know, who knows how we get there, is like full total decommodification, free at the point of contact, public provision of, at the very least, food, housing, healthcare, and education. And then if you
love
want
it.
To do a UBI on top of that, like, yeah, sure, give people some cash, let them play.
For sure. Absolutely. Fully support it. So, Gil, I'd love for you to stick around and talk about some more of, like, how to make the UBI best for everybody. But first, I, of course, have to torture you to prove that you're virtue, right? This is how we prove that you're elect.
Okay.
I got the
grace, baby.
You got the grace. All right, so let's check your epistemic grace here. So this is the enlightening round.
Enlightenment comes from within.
All right, so you're a returner, but for folks who are not, I'm going to give you a list of things. You're going to tell me, are these things real or not real? Those are your only options. You cannot hedge. There are no stakes, and yet you will suffer. Are you ready?
I'm ready, dude. Let's get it.
All right, so as a philosopher, I got to do a basic test here. Are there any things in the world that are real?
Oh, yeah, bud.
Even asking that question's gotten harder over the years. All right, let's find out what is real. Bodies, are they real or not real?
Yes, real.
Minds, real or not real?
Real.
Souls?
Real.
Free will?
Not real.
Luck?
Real.
Ghosts?
Not real.
Aliens?
Real. I don't know.
Truth?
Real.
Beauty?
Real.
And finally, justice?
Real. I'll go real on that. Yeah.
All right. You survived. How do you feel?
Pretty good. I think on the last time, or the last time around, I was pretty realist about everything too.
Yep. You got
what was the one that I said? I just said no to free will. That's
you said no to free will.
Yeah, that's
I respect that about
that's
you.
Virtue signaling on my part.
What was the one that I hedged on
or that I waited for a second?
Justice. There was a little bit of hesitation on aliens.
Oh yeah, aliens. Because like I don't know. Probably, that's like an epistemic question. Like
we'll talk about it. We'll talk about it.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
It's first up on the VIP.
All right.
So things have come along. Do you want folks to know where they can find your other hilarious content?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Aaron. It is great to be here in the void with you as always. I am one of the co-hosts of a podcast called What's Left of Philosophy, which puts out new episodes everywhere. You can find podcasts any 2 weeks, you know, your basic Apple podcast, Spotify, etc. You can also find us online at Left of Phil on What's Left of Twitter. And we have a website, leftofphilosophy.com, where you can find links to all of this. We've also got a merch store. Yeah, we've got a bunch of really exciting episodes coming up soon with some guests who I probably shouldn't name drop tease to the public yet, but there's really good stuff coming down the line and we're excited about where the project's going, so join us. I got other academic work, but it's fine.
It's all with the podcast.
Yeah.
All right, Gil, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much, folks. Stick around, get some more hilarity. Otherwise, thank y'all for listening.
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you, but as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Thanks again to our listeners and patrons who make the show possible. Thanks to our newest monthly voidling, Tom Heheman. I hope that's what that is and not offensive. I'd like to thank our top tier patrons, our Archon level patron, Void Pilled Eldrick Farmer, Alex Beneshek, Serious Inquiries Only, Lawrence Shielding, Fix the Vote, and Grumble Grumble. I'd also like to thank our Archduke level patrons, Big Easy Blasphemy. And finally, of course, all the thanks to our editor, Adam Wick. If you'd like to support the show, please check out my other show, Philosophers in Space, with my co-host Callie Wright of the Queersplaining Podcast. Leave them all the 5-star rating and a review on your podcast app. You can also join us at the Philosophers in Space Facebook group or email me at voidpod@gmail.com. And if you notice a small void growing within you, consider supporting us financially at patreon.com/embracethevoid. Just $4 a month gets you early access to episodes and bonus VIP content. Most of all, whether you think you deserve it or not, you are the void, and the void is you.